Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And my guest today is Mike Farrell. I'm delighted to have Mike on. I think most listeners know who Mike is, but for the few who may not, he's a noted activist, he's an author, he's an actor, and he's best known for his role in the TV series MASH. Today he's a regular lecturer on progressive issues, including human rights and his opposition to imperial wars, torture, poverty, the death penalty. And with those issues go many others, and if you're an activist on one or more, you're really an activist on most all of them. In addition to his biography called Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist, Mike's new book is titled Of Mule and Man, and it's an account of his cross-country book tour, his observations, encounters, presentations, and conversations along the way. Mike, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you, Steve.
Oh, it's great to have you. I remember very well, before we get into the conversation, 40 years ago or so, my kids wanted to see the original MASH movie, so we all went to see it. I guess you could call it a dark comedy. I think you and I would agree, and certainly listeners to this program, that there isn't very much humor in war. And they made a film out of a book that I read long ago. I would call it the starkest, maybe darkest novel about wars and what wars are really like. I don't know if you've ever read Dalton Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun.
Oh, yes, I have.
Oh, it's an absolutely stunning book, and they made a film out of it. I never saw it. I don't know how they could ever film that the way he wrote it. And it was written on the eve of World War II.
Yes.
And to this day, probably the most famous war novel was the Remark book, All Quiet on the Western Front. And I've read a number of books by Kurt Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-Five, on the Dresden firebombing. And he was a POW. He was a German POW at the time. But the Trumbo book was absolutely stunning. And fine man that he was, he became a victim of McCarthyism on the Hollywood blacklist back in the 1950s, I guess.
Yes.
Well, long, long ago. Oh, we want to talk about your book, Mike, and your cross-country trip and the things that you talked about to the groups that you met with. We have a few commercial breaks. When you hear the soft music, I'll interrupt. But why don't you begin and talk about your experience on the road?
I'll be happy to, but let me, if I may, take advantage of your introduction and say that while Trumbo was, I suppose it's fair to say, ruined in terms of his career as a result of the blacklist, a very courageous act by Kirk Douglas brought him back into the fold when Douglas insisted, when he was producing Spartacus, that the only person who could write that film was Dalton Trumbo, and he insisted that he be able to use his real name as during the blacklist period. There were a number of writers who had been blacklisted who made a living by writing under pseudonyms.
I didn't know that.
That's right. I was just going to say we have a history in Hollywood of some pretty dark times, as you suggested, and every once in a while there's somebody that raises his or her head and stands out as a courageous American citizen who believes in civil liberties and the rights of others, and it's nice to remember those things.
Oh, indeed, Michael. You certainly are one of those people, and that's the reason I wanted to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Let's take a break, and
sure,
we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Mike Farrell. Mike, I'm always interested in what's on the minds of people. You got together with so many in the cities that you visited on the book tour. And at the same time, it bothers me that people don't know as much about what's going on as they should, and what they do know doesn't fill in all the blanks that really should be filled in for them. And the reason is because so many people rely on what they see and hear on their TV screens for information, which really isn't information at all. And that's the reason that I got involved in a program like this, to be able to supply good information to people with top guests talking about the biggest issues.
Bless you for that. I think you were quite right that there is a dearth of information out there. Or actually, there's a tremendous amount of information out there, but so much of it is confusing and contradictory that I think people become both confused and somewhat frustrated and turn away from it in too many instances. You asked about the trip. I should give you a little backstory for your audience. I wrote a book you mentioned, Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist. It's a memoir or an autobiography about my life and my career as an actor, as well, and director and producer, but also it's about my life as an activist. And because it's a small production company or a publishing company, they couldn't afford to fly me from city to city, so they asked if I'd mind driving, if they'd rent me a car, which I did, both on the East and the West Coasts. And at one point, when the paperback of the book came out, they asked, the publisher called me and he said, you know, you missed a lot of cities, and said, would you be willing, he said, tell me you enjoy these driving trips, would you be willing to drive all over the country, essentially a loop around the country, ended up being 9,000 miles in 5 weeks.
My goodness.
And I said, I think that'd be great fun. And he said, in addition, when you're doing it, would you do a kind of journal of the trip? And I said, sure. So did, and took the trip that of mule and man really became of mule and man. And it's really a road trip with Mike and Mike's car, which I dubbed the mule because it was hybrid, and with which I developed a great relationship. So the second book really is a kind of sort of a larky version of a crazy trip all over the country, and it's about the country, and it's about a meditation in ways, and the kinds of things you do when you're driving alone at times, and about the people I met and the things I saw, and also about this relationship with this car that I developed, which is a lot of the fun in the book.
Oh, that really is interesting. I personally have driven cross-country 3 times. Once I did alone, when I was in the Army, and that was very exciting for about 4 hours, Mike, and then it got very boring. I just wanted to get from Fort Ord, California to New York, and it seemed like the trip would never end. It's amazing how big this country is. You don't realize it until you drive it end to end.
No, that's quite right. And also what you don't realize is the difference in the topography, the difference in the cultures and the areas that you meet, the people you meet, the changes in approach to life. It's really quite an extraordinary place when you get a chance to look at it. And I must say, beautiful. There are so many parts of the country that are so very different from one another and each in their own way, astonishingly beautiful.
Oh, it really is. The other 2 trips I did with my family, moving from east to San Diego and then back to Chicago, and it was a bit more leisurely. Oh, an extra 2 or 3 days or so. So to get to places like Yellowstone and Mount Rushmore that I never would have gotten to any other way. And the kids love that. And it's even good memories with the kids, Mike, with what kids always say, are we there yet?
Yes. Oh, Daddy, I have to stop now.
Oh, indeed. Well, plenty of that as well. But I never did a tour the way you did to get together with people. That would excite me very much, to get together with groups and discuss the issues that are so crucially important that we talk about in this program all the time.
Sure.
And I've only had a few occasions that I was invited to give a talk, but just tasting it gave me a taste to do it again and again. And I'd love to do it. I've basically said to some people, if somebody wants me to go somewhere and talk about something, I'll be delighted to do it. It's so important to do.
You bet. Absolutely. It's terrifically important. And in my case, because of relationships I've developed over the years, each of the stops was co-sponsored by an organization, either a death penalty abolition organization or the ACLU or some local group, Veterans for Peace or Code Pink or a labor organization. So you get to meet people who are involved in their own way in a given community. And I must say, about half the people in every place I stopped were simply fans of MASH who wanted to know about and talk about and hear about the show.
Oh, I can certainly understand that. On this program, we want to hear about the activism, obviously.
Yes.
One of the big issues for you, Mike, is the death penalty. And I think you live in California.
Yes.
I remember well the case of Stan Tukey Williams. I think you had something to say about that.
I did, indeed.
And I mentioned him in one of my articles. I'm also very concerned about the death penalty. Along with it, I'm very concerned about the U.S. prison system.
Yes.
And a couple of years ago, I wrote an article that I decided to give a very stark title. I called it the U.S. Gulag Prison System, Shame of the Nation, and indeed it is.
Yes, good for you.
And Stan Williams, quite a guy who early in his early years was a gang member and probably a rough guy and big and strong and someone I would guess nobody wanted to tangle with. But I truly believe that he was convicted of a murder. I truly believe he was an innocent man. I truly and absolutely believe it. But without any question, he remade his life in prison. And I read one of his books. I've got it right in my hand. It's called Life in Prison, and it's short. You can easily read it in one sitting. And he wrote the book for young kids to know what prison is really like. And you read this book, and you come away with the feeling, I never want to be in a place like that. It is no fun being in a prison, whether it's a mean and tough one or a lesser one or whatever it is. You do not want to be in prison. And you read this book, and you absolutely, it certainly hit me that it's a place I never want to have anything to do with.
No, absolutely. You're quite right, Stephen. Stanley was an extraordinary man in so many ways. And as you suggest, he, in his young life, as he wrote a number of books, actually, mostly aimed at children in the grammar school years, teaching them to stay away from gangs, stay away from weapons, stay away from drugs, be involved with school, all the things that he fell prey to. The book you mentioned is for the junior high school years, and the reason for that he aimed at that was that he found in his own life and in the lives of so many people he met in both in gang work and in prisons that for young people, particularly young minorities, there is a kind of sense that going to prison is part of your passage to manhood. And that, he said, this is just a terrible perversion of people's, young people's existence, but that's the way it is in the impoverished communities in our country so often. So he wrote this book to try to show young people exactly what you saw in it, which is the horror of this prison life, that it's not something to aspire to. But as you say, Stanley was not only a gang member, he was the founder of the Crips, the now notorious gang that developed into this huge, eventually into this huge feud between the Crips and the Bloods, and has spilled over into all kinds of ugly activity in our country and around the world. But at the time, they were just a self-protective organization, a group of guys trying to stay in their community, trying to stay healthy and stay away from or protected from the attacks on them by other communities. And as he grew up, he developed a kind of native intelligence. He was a quite intelligent man, but not a well-schooled one. But he was very well schooled in survival, and he was arrested, as you suggest, for murder, terrible murders, which he always denied responsibility for, and was only convicted on the basis of the fact that he was by that time a notorious gang leader who the police really wanted off the streets, and he spent the rest of his life in prison. And during that time, he had an extraordinary conversion. diversion from the kind of street life into a much more thoughtful man who decided that he wanted to make a change in his life and try to reach out to young people to see that they didn't make the same mistakes he did, and that resulted in the series of books he wrote.
Oh, indeed so. And tragically, your governor executed him about 3.5 years ago. Just a terrible loss. Even in prison, he could have done so much.
That's exactly the point we tried to make to the governor time and time again. You call him my governor, and I guess technically he is. I don't claim him.
Oh, indeed. I don't claim mine either.
We said, look, yes, first of all, Stanley has always denied guilt, but aside from that, the man has done extraordinary good while he's been in prison in terms of the work he's done with young people all over the... I mean, his books were distributed in schools and had an enormous impact on young people. And aside from that, via videotape, he was able to negotiate a truce between the two gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, that on some level still exists today.
Oh, that is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. It's amazing, Mike, how politics can get... even good people, I don't know that I'd put that label on Governor Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
But even good people can be corrupted by the political system. It really is a shame.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Mike Farrell. Mike, one more comment on the death penalty, and then I'd love to talk about what people raised with you in the cities that you visited.
Sure.
In my state, a few years ago, we had Governor George Ryan, and George Ryan, about 3 years ago, was convicted on corruption charges. And I never remembered him as a particularly good governor, except for one remarkable thing that he did. About half a dozen years ago, he commuted the sentences of about 160-odd to death row prisoners because, in his words, what he called the demon of error, wrongfully committed prisoners, and give a lot of credit to a group of students at Northwestern University, volunteered a project that they literally dug up exonerating evidence on a number of death row prisoners. And around 2000, he suspended the death penalty. And then a few years after that, he just commuted the sentences of these people. So many innocent people wrongfully convicted, and then they put them to death.
Yes.
Because nobody cares about them. Nobody does the work that these kids and a professor at Northwestern University did on their own as a class project. Just amazing.
It is amazing. There are a number of aspects to this that... bring back a lot for me. I became a friend of George Ryan's. I contacted him when he declared the moratorium and congratulated him. I was very surprised when he took my call. Ryan described himself as a conservative, rock-ribbed Republican death penalty supporter, but he said that what he had seen as a result of the work, as you've suggested, of this group of students at Northwestern, what he had seen was that the system was broken, and he needed to figure out how to fix it. And he and I developed a friendship over time. In fact, I testified at his trial as a character witness. But the metamorphosis of George Ryan over the time that I knew him, from 2000 to the time he was convicted, actually I still know him. We communicate by mail. Was from this man who was, he said, look, Mike, he said, I don't want to fool you. I still believe in the death penalty. I voted for it when I was in a member of the assembly or whatever the legislative body was. And he said, I've always believed in it. But he said, without much thought, I just thought that it was, what you do. And as we came to know each other over the years, where he established the commission that you know about in Illinois, made up very carefully of one half people who supported the death penalty and one half people who opposed it, to examine the use of the death penalty in the system in Illinois and make a determination as to how to make it work better. That was the only assignment of the commission. As that commission moved forward and as Ryan began to examine the process, and when the commission finally, 2 years later, handed in its results, its report, it said that in order to make the system work better, it would take 95 changes in the law. And at the time, they said unanimously, we cannot guarantee that even with these changes, this process will not capture and execute an innocent person. And that was the problem in Illinois at the time. They had executed, I believe, 12 people, and 13 had been exonerated and freed based on the fact that they were not guilty of the crime and that they'd been condemned for. So Ryan then was faced with a commission's report and a legislature that was unwilling to make the changes necessary. There was a lot of political, as you can imagine, a lot of political opposition to the changes. The police didn't want to have themselves more constricted in terms of what they wanted, were able to do. The prosecutors didn't want to be able to be limited in how they could do their jobs. All from the commission's point of view, in the interests of fairness. But nonetheless, the legislature balked, so Governor Ryan was faced with this situation of ending his term in office and faced with 167 people on their death row. And he finally examined cases, went through a torturous process, and finally made the determination you talked about, which is to commute every one on death row, except for four people that he freed completely, saying that he believed they were innocent. Commuted all people on Illinois' death row to life without parole, which was to keep the public safe, which is the whole point of the criminal justice system. In the entire process, he became an opponent of the death system. He said it simply does not work.
Oh, indeed, it doesn't work. I see it as a metaphor for so much that's broken in the country. And I think an example, I mentioned it yesterday on the program, an example that the Senate voted overwhelmingly not to appropriate funds to close Guantanamo. Guantanamo is an absolute blight. It's in a special blight. And I wrote about it many months back, where at minimum, most of the prisoners held there committed no crime.
Yes.
Absolutely innocent. Most were picked up on bounty
in
Afghanistan. Either as an Al-Qaeda or as a Taliban. So you don't like your neighbor, turn them in as one or the other and get a nice bounty. So innocent people were picked up, and it made us look politically, all political, made us look politically like we were taking bad people out of circulation. We took a lot of innocent people out of circulation, pretended they were bad people, and they're still being held there. And now apparently nothing will be done to help these people.
Well, in fact, I believe it will. The president, as he said yesterday morning, is intending to close Guantanamo and will.
Well, the problem is they may just ship them to another torture prison, Mike. I suspect that's what will happen, and they won't bring them to the U.S.
Well, I
can't imagine that San Quentin would be a lovely alternative. Even better than Guantanamo.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Mike Farrell. Mike, I want to talk about your tour, and let me first read a comment on the cover of your book, Of Mule and Man, comment by Ron Kovic, who wrote Born on the 4th of July. And his comment is that not since Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie in Search of America has there been a more beautifully written and compelling journey into the heartland of America. Mike Farrell celebrates his beloved country with great honesty and sincerity, with humility and grace, a beautiful and courageous book, an American classic. It's a very strong statement, a lovely statement by a guy who I think another guy that listeners would be familiar with.
Indeed. Ron is a wonderful, dedicated man, and I was thrilled that he was willing to take a look at the book, and even more delighted, obviously, at his reaction to it.
Oh, indeed so. But you made this the ninth, math is not my best suit. I'm trying to think what percentage of the entire globe 9,000 miles is, Mike. A lot.
Yeah, well, we're 3,000 miles across, so that figures I could have done it three times.
Indeed. But the people you met, you got together with, what were the things that came up on their mind or that you addressed with them?
Well, as you can imagine, and as I said earlier, a significant number of the people wanted to talk about MASH, but it was wonderful because there was this sort of wide array of issues that were discussed based on the area we were in, based on the concerns of the individuals who came. At the time, the campaign, the presidential campaign was going on, and I remember at one point I was speaking, I think I was in Baltimore, Maryland, and a woman raised her hand and said, what three things can I do or can we do to help move this country forward? And I said, vote for Barack Obama, vote for Barack Obama, vote for Barack Obama.
Oh, I read that statement, indeed.
Everybody laughed, and but I meant it. That for people who can't get out and do other things, the minimum they can do is exercise their obligation as a citizen to be involved in the campaigns and to cast their votes. But, you know, talking to people who were in New Orleans, for example, when I went down into the lower Ninth Ward to see the damage that continues to exist there, it makes me so angry, Stephen, it's hard to put it into words, to see the horror of the lives of the people that were ruined by that flood, and who never really received the support, the succor, the care from the government that they deserved. To go from there to Washington, D.C., and to meet some labor organizers and people who are interested in dealing with the lobbying and the in Congress and struggling against the power of the lobbyists, the big money lobbyists from so many of the industries that are making themselves wealthy on our backs. And then to go up into Michigan where the people have been so hard hit by the economic downturn and the job loss that I was in, you know, and sometimes talk radio shows have premiums if people, the third person to call in can get the following or some sort of way to get a prize. And I was stunned to hear that what they were offering as these premiums in Michigan were bags of groceries and a tank full of gasoline. And I thought this is a measure of how low these people have fallen and how needful they are. And something's got to be done to help these folks.
Oh, it's everywhere, Mike. It is absolutely everywhere. I live in downtown Chicago, and I can walk a mile, 2 miles from where I live, and there are poor black families that they miss meals. They go hungry. The kids can go to school in the morning, very subpar schools, because the city has absolutely decimated public education. I've written about that in some detail.
Good for you.
Been mentioned it a couple of other times. But these kids go to school. They haven't had a meal. Their parents are so poor, in such bad shape, they literally go to school hungry. And if there isn't any kind of a school lunch program, then they may struggle to get through the day. Well, how did a hungry kid learn? Then you've got a bad environment to begin with, so you've got all that to contend with. I might mention, by the way, you mentioned Katrina, the Lower Ninth in New Orleans. That event is what really made me a writer. I'm a retired small business guy, and I never intended to do any of this, but I did something accidentally. I wrote an accidental brief book report that preceded writing about Katrina, and the author of the book asked me if I could get it posted. And I got a couple of websites to post it, and then Katrina came along right on the back of that. And I was so upset with what I saw happening right from the start that these people literally would be left in the lurch.
Yes.
That the whole idea was, let this disaster happen. Get rid of these poor black people. Turn the the valuable land over to developers, so they could build condos and more amusement things that New Orleans is famous for. Make a buck out of it, and just ethnically cleanse these people out of New Orleans, and that's exactly what happened. And these people had lost what they had, a good many of them, forever.
Uh-huh.
And you saw it firsthand recently. I haven't been there. I haven't seen it, but I've seen pictures and I've read so much about it and written about it. But this launched me as a writer, and from there, I just went on to other topics.
Well, good for you.
It obsessed me. But any other major? If people ask me what I could do to affect change in the country or whatever, I think I'd begin, Mike, by saying something like, number one, get informed.
Mm-hmm.
Find out what's going on and don't get it from your TV screen or morning newspaper.
Good for you.
Go online and get it from – there are lots of good websites online. There are good programs, a lot of good ones. I hope this is one of them. And you can learn. Get informed and get together with other people, join an organization, and realize that what you're doing is in self-defense. That we
yes.
keep seeing things deteriorate more and more, whether we're talking about foreign wars of aggression, another issue that concerns you, torture. I suspect that your feeling about Obama is not quite as strong as it was a few months ago.
Well, you know, when in the speech in Grant Park after he was elected, he said, I'm going to do a lot of things and I'm going to bring change to the country, but I'm going to do some things that aren't going to make you happy. And I think that's almost inevitable in a leader, particularly in a situation like he finds himself. And you're quite right. There are some of the things he's done that have made me very unhappy, and I've let him know to the degree I can do that. But I think it's important for us to understand that there is such a thing as a loyal opposition in this country. It doesn't have to be the kind of ideological numbness that is being demonstrated in Congress, where they just simply try to stop every advance he makes because they want him to fail. That's a very different thing than saying, Mr. President, I disagree very strongly with your decision about the non-release of these photographs, for example, or non-prosecution of the torturers. These are things that I believe very strongly in that have to be done in order to wipe clean the slate that has been so marred by the behavior of the previous administration. And Mr. Obama, I think, is making mistakes when he wants to look only forward and not backward, some for political reasons and some because he believes that he's got a mandate to do that. But I think, you know, we can, I'm associated with an organization, Human Rights Watch, that took part in a meeting 2 days ago in the White House, debating these very issues, debating issues of the closure of Guantanamo, about what you do with these people who are confined there at this point, some of whom are probably bad actors, some of whom are probably people that tried to do or did some terrible things, and they need to be prosecuted, but they need to be prosecuted fairly, appropriately, under the kinds of systems that we've developed in this country, not by this military commission nonsense that the Bush administration put together that really is only a guarantee of conviction and has no real intention to do a serious job of examining the evidence and making a determination based on fact. So there's, I do disagree with many of the things the president is doing, but I applaud many of the things he's doing, and I think that's part of the process of our working our way through the future with to take into consideration the needs and the desires of all of the people.
Oh, indeed. Well, you do some writing, and I know it shows up on the Huffington Post. And you wrote one article about a month ago. You called it Turning Nuremberg on Its Head, and you
yes.
talked about the torture issue, prosecuting the Bush people who absolutely were involved and guilty of sanctioning torture, just twisting U.S. and international law. I cite it so often in my own writing, Mike. It's very, very clear whether we're talking about Geneva, Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, a U.S. law. We've got a U.S. War Crimes Act. We've got a U.N. Convention on Torture. There's no ambiguity in these laws. It's very clear.
That's right.
Torture is absolutely prohibited in all cases, at all times, and never is there an exception for any reason.
No, nor should there be. And to hear the former vice president trotting all over the media, national media, and making these specious claims about the value of the process and the work they did and how the good they did as a result of it and how wrong-headed Mr. Obama is really infuriates me.
Oh, absolutely. Torture elicits nothing. If you beat up on somebody badly enough, long enough, they'll tell you anything you want to hear.
That's right. And most of it is exactly that, what you want to hear rather than what the truth is.
Exactly. You just want them to stop beating up on you. And I have written in graphic detail what we have done to people. And there may be a few scattered bad ones in there, but there have been very few charges brought against anybody. Most of these people have been held for years and years, going back post 9/11, just sitting there in what I call torture prisons.
Yeah.
Not just Guantanamo, that's just one. We have so many offshored. I wonder how many listeners, and I wonder whether you know, Mike, that we have torture ships at sea, in the middle of heaven knows what ocean, and out of sight, out of mind. Who knows what goes on these ships?
Yes.
Well, it certainly is the same things that go on at Guantanamo, at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, the bases in countries around the world, Poland, the Middle East, countries who do our bidding. I know in Egypt, I know in Syria, I know in, I think, Morocco, other Eastern European countries. They can move them around. They can have them in one place and then emphasize another. But this stuff still exists. And
very much so.
Not a word from Obama about stopping this.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, one of the interesting things is that we've developed now international law to the degree that if, as I've written, if the administration does not do its duty, you're going to find Judge Garzon in Spain bringing charges, as he did in the case of General Pinochet, and further humiliating the United States by having the perpetrators brought up on charges under terms of international law.
Oh, I will have a future program on this. I believe, I don't know whether it's the same judge, but the Spanish court apparently will hear charges against a number of Bush officials, including John Yoo.
Yeah.
I believe Alberto Gonzalez, John Ashcroft, David Addington, a real rogues gallery of people.
Mr. Bybee.
Bybee,
yes.
A federal judge now, no less.
Yes.
I mean, just absolutely outrageous. These people are criminals. They absolutely should be held to account.
Mm-hmm.
And to do anything less is absolutely inexcusable.
I couldn't agree more.
So maybe a Spanish court will end up doing what no one has the courage to do in this country.
Wouldn't that be a sad statement about the system in this country?
Oh, it's a very sad statement. But I think Obama needs to push harder on this. And I know he has opposition in Congress. I think 90 senators voted against appropriating funds to bring the Guantanamo prisoners to the U.S.
Well, part of that, you know, Stephen, is just plain pandering to the fear that's been developed by the right, these senators who take this position. I'm thinking of writing something called The Magic Terrorist. Somehow they expect they have bought into the notion that these people who are so-called terrorists have superhuman abilities to somehow fade through walls, as though we in this country don't have professional enough staffs in our prisons and secure enough prisons to hold these people. It's just astonishing to me that they can play these kinds of fears out in their own heads and then cast a vote or make a statement like Harry Reid did the other day about these terrorists. None of them will ever be on American soil. If we're going to do away with Guantanamo, as I believe we will, we're going to have to find a way to bring these people into our nation and try them in our courts, as we already have with terrorists over time. And they're not superhuman people who can somehow become invisible and walk through walls. They are people just like everybody else who have, those of them who, that are guilty, who have a kind of fanatic desire to do harm based on their own hyper-religious beliefs. But nonetheless, they deserve to have a day in court. And so many of them, as you've said, are guilty of nothing at all and must have their day in court so that those they can be exonerated and freed.
I'd say most important, if there are no charges to bring against any of them, they absolutely should be freed.
Yes.
I think more than that, we owe them restitution. We owe them public restitution. It'll never happen. The politics would never allow it to happen. But it's one of many blots on this country. It really is shameful, and it never gets discussed in the mainstream. It's just the bad guys that are there, and it is. It's very painful, very, very painful. It bothers me no end. I'm sure I'm not done writing about this and so much else.
Good.
I think if you want a definition of a terrorist, Mike, stretching the definition a little bit, think of the criminal lenders that suckered people into unaffordable mortgages and inflated a housing bubble that really kind of ignited the whole economic crisis that we're going through right now. And these people, especially the big ones, are being rewarded with trillions of our tax dollars.
Right.
Talk about outrage. Now, there's a real outrage that I've had an awful lot to say about. Oh, we need to take another break, and then we'll have a final segment. I'll give it all to you, Mike, and any final thoughts from your tour and whatever else is on your mind. We'll be
okay,
right
thank
back.
You.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Segment with Mike Farrell. Mike's books, again, easily gotten through Amazon. His biography called Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist, and his newest book, Of Mule and Man, an account of his cross-country tour and the conversations and people he met along the way. Mike, final thoughts from your trip, your book, or whatever else is on your mind?
Well, indeed, we've touched on a lot of things, Stephen, and I appreciate it. You know, in terms of final thoughts, I think your point a little while ago was a very good one that I'd like to pick up on, and that is that so many people feel frustrated and confused by the avalanche of information that comes their way, most of it intended either to befuddle them or to sell a product or to steer them in a direction that's really not to their benefit. And I think people in this country forget a couple of things. One is they forget how privileged we are to live the existence we do. Those of us, even those of us in less advantageous circumstances, are far better off than most of the people in the world. And with that forgetting, I think, comes a lack of appreciation of the fact that we each have a particular talent, a particular characteristic, a particular unique ability that that needs to be not only recognized but utilized. People, you know, wonder what they can do or wonder why they aren't feeling better, sometimes because they simply don't involve themselves. And from my perspective, being involved in our society, being involved in our world is an urgently necessary and important thing. And it's one that pays dividends in ways that you really won't even appreciate until you do it. But it doesn't necessarily involve traveling the world, as I've had the good fortune to be able to do, or even driving around the country, as I had the good fortune to be able to do and wrote about in Mule and Man. It means involving yourself in however you can do that in a constructive manner, whether it's using your talent as a to reach out to young people, to involve yourself in a community effort, to deal in some way with a family issue that needs to be confronted, to not only to vote but to inform yourself, as you've said. You know, Thomas Jefferson said the great strength of this nation was an involved and informed electorate. And if we don't inform ourselves, and by informing ourselves, I would underscore your point about not just taking the words that are spewed out at you from the television set or the the general mainstream media, but do a little investigation. There's this wonderful thing called Google where you can punch in the letters that speak to a particular issue that you're concerned about and find yourself with a load of opportunities to speak to people and organizations and experts who can inform you about those issues, and organizations that want your support and your help and your involvement. So for me, the important thing for Americans to understand is, one, how lucky they are, and two, how privileged they are, and three, my dear friend, now gone, John O'Donohue, said we must realize that the duty of privilege is absolute integrity. And by that, he means caring about yourself and caring about your neighbors and finding ways to use your abilities, your strengths, your powers for the benefit of your neighbors and yourselves.
And the easiest way to lose our freedoms is not to work to preserve them.
Indeed.
Your voice, we're out of time, Mike. Your voice has resonance because of your prominence. People wonder, what can I do by myself? Well, I'm by myself. Nobody knew me from Adam, but in a few years, I've touched people and reached people on every continent, something I thought was absolutely impossible, but I did it.
Oh, bless you for that.
Oh, well, it's a great experience, and it's all volunteer. I love it all. Mike, we're out of time. I've got to break away, but my great thanks to you for coming on. It was a wonderful hour with you.
It's been my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you.
And we'll be back Monday with more live programming.